My name's Adele Onyango, and welcome to another episode of Legally Clueless. No, seriously, I have no clue what I'm doing, but I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one. Hey you, welcome to episode 305 of Legally Clueless. Thank you so much for rocking with this podcast. If you're new here, episodes like this go out every single Monday. And this is what's coming up in this episode.
Around 98, my dad became ill. He was paralyzed from the waist downwards. He was hospitalized for at least a year and a half, if not 2 years. When my dad passed on, a lot happened from the pastors who were ministering with my dad. You know, they took over the different branches. My uncle, you know, grabbed whatever my mom and my dad had invested in the rural place.
That's Monday. We're about to get to part one of her very inspiring story. But before we do that, 2025, how has it started for you? I feel like there's a different energy this year, an amazing energy about it. And I'll tell you why. There feels like there's an acknowledgement, at least on my end, not only about what you need to do to make your life better or get closer to your highest self, but an acknowledgement that you can and you should be an active participant in your life. I hope this is not just me who's feeling this, or the people I'm surrounding myself with, or the things I am reading and listening to. I really hope this is the same energy you're feeling, right? Because I feel like there is so much power when you realize that you aren't helpless and there are many parts of your life that aren't happening to you that you can hit back, you can amplify, you can participate. Doesn't that feel great? And again, I truly hope I'm not the only one feeling this energy. So on whatever platform you're listening to this episode on, drop a comment and let me know whether you feel that there's this powerful, energizing energy that's starting off 2025. Speaking of being an active participant, though, I did share about three things on sleep, on morning routines, well, my morning routine, and how I'm trying to reduce my screen time. So reduce the time I spend on my phone. I shared this on our newsletter last week. First and foremost, thank you to everyone who sent back so many emails sharing their routines. There's one person, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to shame, but sent the email in at about 11 p.m. and was like, look, you can clearly see I do not have an evening routine because I need to be up at 5 and I'm here emailing you at 11 p.m. But just to have those conversations going between us, that's super powerful to me. That's one. The second thing is I have laid out a challenge that I'm going to be sending you those newsletters every week. Reason being, if I'm not intentional about it, it's not going to get done. And I do want to give the things that matter to me, like you and our wellness, the intentionality they deserve. Two, there's so much knowledge that can help us improve our wellness. And it helps if we just share that knowledge with each other. So weekly newsletters are how to do it. So the next newsletter is going out this Wednesday. And if you haven't signed up for a newsletter, you can do so. There's a link in the show notes. Let's jump right into Mwende's story about breasts and therapy.
100 African stories on Legally Clueless. Stories from Africa.
My name is Mwende Mutiso. I'm 31 years old. I am a psychology and counseling student. And I'm also a health advocate, which it's something which I started a few years ago, about 5-6 years ago. I'll take you back to my childhood. I am the fifth born in our family, the last one. And growing up, we had a very wholesome life. My dad was a bishop. My mom was a businesswoman, still is. And I have 4 siblings, 1 brother who's the firstborn, and the rest are my sisters. So it was quite an interesting time to, you know, grow up, because like the age gap between my brother and I is quite big. He has always been very authoritative, and being the only male in our family, you know, so it was quite an interesting time. Also growing up in a spiritual background, a Christian background, so going to church was mandatory. That was non-negotiable. Some of the moments which I hold dear, the memories are the family game nights we had. I think the family game nights were on Thursdays, and then on Tuesdays it was Bible study. And my dad made it so fun, so we didn't feel obliged to be part of it, but we were looking forward to it, because even with the Bible study, it was more of like games, you know, Bible games, and then we would compete with each other. So it was really, you know, that's how we grew up. We grew up in Eastleigh, near Pumwani Hospital. There was a compound which had houses and a church. It was initially owned by missionaries, so it was, you know, like a bit of a runda in Eastleigh, because there were so many trees and flowers, and there were not apartments but houses, so it was like, you know, limited people who were living there. So growing up as well, we had these rituals, the things which we used to keep on doing. So when it was so cold, like June, July, since we had a chimney, we would go collect firewood, you know, light up the fireplace, have some cocoa, and, you know, as a family, just sit, tell stories. It was quite interesting, because when you get out of this compound, the world was different. You know, outside it didn't particularly, you know, you wouldn't tell it's the same when in Eastleigh, basically. By late 90s, around 98, my dad became ill. To date, I actually don't know what he had per se, but I know he was paralyzed from the waist downwards. So he was quite ill, and at some point, I think he was hospitalized for at least a year and a half, if not 2 years. That was quite a shift, even in terms of my upbringing. My dad was my primary caregiver, since my mom was working full-time, and my dad, since he was a bishop, so I used to spend most of the time with him. I was the youngest, so I was not in school. When he got ill, it really took, now I can understand what was happening emotionally for me, it took a toll on me, because that is the, you know, as a young girl, my dad was, I had seen him healthy throughout, you know, barely was he getting ill. So for him being so ill that he was hospitalized, and when he was discharged, he would spend, you know, most of the time on the bed. It was quite a different shift, because I was used to my father, who we used to now run with and play with, you know, we used to race together. And when we were alone at home, that is actually what we used to do. I think that's why I also love games and playing with my nieces and nephews, because that's one of the ways we were bonding a lot, you know, either playing or reading books. So seeing this other side of my dad, he was definitely trying a lot to still keep up, but I could notice that he was struggling. So that was tough. And then at some point in the 90s, he started getting better, and he started walking with even crutches. So when he started walking, we would now go for walks in the same compound. You know, it was designed in quite an interesting way. There was like grounds, you know, for playing, which was in a circular. And then around it was like, was it a, It was more like a road or a track. So we used to go all the way around and just, you know, walk around. And that was also really wonderful, just spending time with my dad. So I spend a lot of time, I have to say, and I'm so grateful for those moments. So, and then after that, he got again unwell and he was hospitalized. So by, I think, around beginning, end of 1999 or beginning of 2000. And when he was hospitalized, so now that's when he passed on. He didn't come back home. I think he passed on after about 6 months. So yeah, that was quite, it was tough, not just for me, but I will say for the whole family, you know, including, if not, especially my mom. You know, she had stopped working because she was not the primary caregiver for my dad. So she stopped working and she used to just go to the hospital, you know, wake up early in the morning, go to hospital before she comes back. We were already asleep. So we also barely saw our mom. And then so when my dad passed on, a lot happened from, you know, like the pastors who were ministering with my dad, you know, they took over the different branches. My uncle, you know, grabbed whatever my mom and my dad had invested in the rural place. And now the only thing my mom was left with was at the property she has or the assets she had here in Nairobi. And now 5 children who are looking up to her. And her business had really, you know, it had collapsed because she was not taking care of it since she was, you know, in and out of hospital. So it was quite a tough time, a period for all of us as a family when my dad passed on. Some of my siblings had to even start working at that time because we didn't have an income, you know. I also started going to the Maasai market, and I think by then I was 9. So my dad passed on when I was 8. So by around when I was 9, I started going to Maasai market to also support my mom with, you know, selling the Maasai sandals. But I have to say I was enjoying it totally. That is where I also learned, you know, the different cultures. And it was so amazing to see different people from different countries who were, you know, dressed differently, you know. And, you know, Maasai market is such a beautiful and colorful place to be in. You see different art. So, you know, it was really, I always looked forward to going to the market every Saturdays and Sundays. And that's how I basically started working. We would go with my mom sometimes and my sisters. And at some point, my sisters were looking for different jobs. So I used to go with my mom most of the time, or I would also go alone. We would have like an agreement with my mom. So she will tell me how much she wants for like a pair of sandals. And then whatever I make on top of that was mine. So I started becoming an entrepreneur kitambo, you know, a while back. So that's how I grew up. And through high school, through primary school, it was easier since the education was free, thanks to now the then President Kibaki. Then high school was a bit of a challenge. Since I used to be sent home for school fees so often. So when I was sent home, I would go work with my mom. And then once I accumulate a bit of cash, I go back to school. So that was my high school. I think even in Form 4, I went for a maximum of maybe 2 terms all accumulatively. Even the last term, remember I stayed home for like a month before I went, you know, to now sit for my exams. So that was a challenge. We were struggling. And at the same time, at the same period, you know, where we used to live now, that near Pumwani, the place was demolished. And my mom's workshop was there. So when it was demolished, she lost everything, including her stock and her tools to make now the sandals. So again, we had to, you know, she had to start from, you know, the square one. And we got some people who are willing to support. For quite a few months, we lived with people and we had to now start again from square one. My sisters had to look, you know, they lived with their friends who took them in. And I went with my mom. So we couldn't go all of us in the same place. We were too many. We were four. Yeah, and then we stayed for a few months and my mom was able to start again her business. And we got a space in, yeah, the demolition happened in 2009 because we got a space in 2010 where we now went to, you know, we all moved in with my sisters and we started again. One thing I know, especially after the house was demolished, is as a family, we had this thing to date, you know, we laugh at the challenges which life throws at us. So we used to actually make fun of what was happening. And I'm sure it's a coping mechanism, but we used to still spend time together as we just laugh at what was happening, because some of these things were so unbelievable. You know, it sounds like a script of a movie, like how many horrible things can happen to one family in such a short time, you know. But anyway, yeah, so that happened and we started again. My sisters got jobs, you know, corporate jobs. I was able to finish high school. So I finished high school in 2011. Immediately I finished my high school, I think it was in November, I started looking for a job because, again, I was so used to doing something more, you know, extra, not just schoolwork. I got a promotion job. So I was doing like a marketing for Unilever products in the supermarket. But my goal was to go to university because I've always wanted to do, you know, to have a degree and master's. You know, I wanted to study. I've always had that passion. Yeah, so I started doing the promotions and then I started learning how to do graphic designs. And I landed myself an internship with an NGO because of now the graphic design skills I had. That was in 2013. So I started now my internship in 2013. At that time, I was being paid something like... When I started, I was being paid something like $3,500 a month. And then I was, you know, I got a promotion, quote unquote, then I was being paid $4,500 a month, then $5,000. But the reason I still stuck with the internship is because I wanted to do more with my life and I felt like my chances of acquiring more skills were better doing the internship as opposed to doing the promotions. Yeah, because with the promotion, they were paying quite well. It was, I think, 1,000 shillings per day. In 1 week's duration, I was actually earning what I was earning in this internship. But I was learning way more than I would have learned at, you know, the aisles of a supermarket. I did the internship for about 3 years, so from 2013 to 2016. People are starting to even make fun of me saying I've become a professional intern because I did an internship with them. Then I did another internship with another nonprofit which works with governance issues through the same organization. So I was acquiring a lot of skills, not earning a lot, but I was learning quite a bit. Then I did, at the same time, I got an opportunity to do babysitting. And I got a babysitting gig. And so I went to do this in Switzerland in 2015. So when I came back, I was actually able to now enroll to university. This was 5 years after I did high school because my goal was still to enroll in university. And at that time, I still want to do psychology and counseling. So I wanted to do that because of also my own lived experience. I noted how it was, you know, it was quite challenging growing up, and some of the things which normally we were not addressed, or I felt were not being addressed, was like the mental health bit. And I, growing up, I had a challenge even, you know, relating with people. Now I know why, but I remember it. I had a lot of challenge even relating with my peers. I was always that, you know, timid girl who would sit at the corner, back room, you know, to be as invisible as I could be. So going to the market, for instance, for me was a break, because I knew which conversation I needed to have with the person. They want shoes, so I'm selling shoes and that's it. So having even small talk was quite a challenge. Growing up, I would even prefer playing alone as opposed to playing with other children. I was most of the time surrounded by adults, since I was the only one who was not in school. So when my dad was going to visit his friends, we would go together. So I was really surrounded by adults most of my childhood and not children. And that, again, was making it more challenging, you know, relating with my peers.
I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'm so glad that you're part of this family. We're taking a small ad break, but we'll be right back. And now, back to the episode.
Yeah, but I also learned communication when I was now going to the market, because at the same time, you have to have a small talk, a skill. But now when I really, really started being more keen about my mental health, I would say it's probably in 2016. And now this is when I was first diagnosed with breast cancer. So after my first diagnosis with now breast cancer, it was stage zero, and I was diagnosed around May, June 2016, and then I had a mastectomy in September the same year, which is now removal of the whole breast. But the cancer had not spread. So that was I did two surgeries, and then I was put on medication, hormonal therapy, a tablet a day for 5 years. So it was a short cancer journey in terms of treatment. So by September, end of September, November, I was done with the treatment and I was just on medication. What I was then doing was, I developed this condition called lymphedema. So it's swelling. It's, you know, when your lymph system is not working correctly. I still have it. My right hand swells every now and then. Because, you know, when I had my breast removed, they also removed like lymph nodes in underneath my arm, in the armpit and what have you. It disrupted the lymphatic system and the drainage. So what this is like, you know, the lymphatic fluid is not flowing as it should. And what happens, because it's not a curable condition, what now happens is when it swells so much, you need to now start doing physio. And then there's this like a glove called a compression sleeve, which you need to be wearing to just, you know, compress the hand. So you need to manage. I found out about this when it actually happened. When I went to the hospital, I'm like, oh my God, my hand is swelling. The doctor told me it's normal. It's because of the surgery. Taking you back to 2014, you know, the program which I joined in high school had different aspects in terms of, you know, the topics they would teach. So one of the times they had a medical camp, and there was a breast cancer survivor who came to show us how to do now self-breast examination. So now through that medical camp I went to in 2014, I started doing the self-breast examination on myself. Not because I thought I would get cancer, but because it was a skill which I learned. And I thought, you know, it's okay to just, you know, use a skill which I've learned. So I learned of the tumor in my breast. stressed when I was actually watching TV on the sofa and I was doing the examination. I used to just do it very, you know, casually. So you use your three fingers and then you apply a bit of pressure on your breasts and then, you know, in that circular motions to check if you will feel anything. With the tumors, what you will probably feel is something hard. Normally there is no pain at all associated with it, but we also know that with breast cancer, you don't necessarily need to have a lump. There are breast cancers which have been diagnosed and people don't have the lumps. So you check the whole of your breasts, the collarbone, armpit, to check if there's any swelling, you know, with the breast. Is one of your breasts too big, you know, way bigger than the other one? Is the skin of your breasts, does it have the, you know, like pores? You see how an orange looks like, you know, does it look like that? Is there any discharge which you're having from your nipple? So these are some of the things you look at. When you lift up your hands together, when you're facing, you know, you can also look at yourself in the mirror. And when you're raising your hands, are your both your breasts going simultaneously up? If one is lagging behind, it means it's heavier than the other. It could be a red flag. So what you really need to know is your normal, so that when there's something amiss, you can spot it quite instantly. Because for me, since I was doing this self-examination for at least a year, so I already knew how my breast felt. And I knew how they felt before my menses, during my menses, after my menses. So I could tell that small thing I was feeling in my breast has never been there. So it's really important to know your normal. So that's how I noticed. And it took me about at least maybe a month. And I was looking, you know, I was doing the examination quite frequently. And sometimes I could feel it, sometimes not, because it felt like a small bee, even a bean is big. It was something really small, but very hard. And it would move, you know, it was not stationed in one spot. So when after a while it became a little bit bigger and I went to have it checked in a nearby clinic, the doctors just, you know, brushed it off because I was 23 years at that time. And in our family, we didn't have any history of any type of cancer. So I was told it would go away on its own. That was December 2015. Around, you know, and then January comes, I join university. I keep on checking my breasts. And then around February, I think I went back to hospital. I went to about 3-4 hospitals by around May 2016. In one hospital, I was told it's hormonal imbalance. There's another one, I was given antibiotics and told, you know, it will, you know, I was given antibiotics to treat the lump. But by around May, now the tumor had grown quite big. It was now very, you know, I could feel it. And I could also tell now my right breast was a bit bigger than my left one. And initially, it was vice versa. When I was now on my normal, my left one was bigger than my right one. So I could also tell the difference in terms of size. So, but again, still, there was no pain at all. So I went to now Umata Hospital in May 2016, and I did a test called FNA, fine needle aspiration, where they take a sample, like a sample fluid or something from now the tumor to check if it's cancer. It was inconclusive. Then I was sent to do a test called core biopsy, where they now take a sample of the tissue to check. But now, because I was so green, and so was, you know, the rest of my family members, so we were looking for the cheapest alternatives. And honestly, I also wanted to just finish, you know, whatever, to just get done with this, you know, the test, so that I can resume university. We had just finished the first semester and we had closed for the long holidays. So I wanted to just, you know, get over with that so that in September I can resume university and continue, you know, doing my degree. We got advice since we were asking different people for advice. And one of the advice we got is that, you know, I can just go and do a surgery called lumpectomy. They remove the tumor and the surrounding tissue. At that time, I didn't even know what the surgery, if the surgery had a name. But what they told us is we can just remove the tumor and instead of doing the core biopsy because it's much cheaper. So we had the surgery before the diagnosis, which should not be the case. When we did that, I went to, if there's not the results came back and it showed that I had now. I was diagnosed with something with a breast cancer called ductal carcinoma in situ. So it's stage zero breast cancer, which is also the doctors also call it pre-cancer because it's not invasive and they're just, you know, like cells which have overgrown in the milk duct. So it's the earliest you can catch a breast cancer and it's the easiest to treat actually. So we had I went to one of the public hospitals to now start my treatment. But before this we did I think two other tests to just confirm the results were actually true since we didn't believe it. So once we were convinced that I did have breast cancer, I started the cancer treatment journey. At the hospital, the queues were so long and I didn't have any insurance, including NHIF. So what ended up happening was we did a fundraiser. So we went to, Kenyatta and the queues were too long. I was told I will do now the radiotherapy. I was told I needed to do 30 sessions and the queue was so long in that I was scheduled for the following year, January, which was now 6 months post the surgery. So now that is where now my former colleagues supported in terms of even fundraising, you know, my family, my friends, my family's friends, you know, friends of friends. So they supported us through a fundraiser and I was able to go to a private hospital. And at the same time, I was also looking for different solutions. So I managed to get in a program. Actually, when I was getting into this program, we had not done the fundraiser yet. So when I got in a program which I think was funded by Beyond Zero campaign. So I was going to do the full 30 sessions, radiotherapy sessions at Aga Khan for free. I went to now the private hospital through the program. And then before I started now the radiotherapy, of course, the radio-oncologist needs to examine and check all the records. And I had done so many tests already, but they needed to check. Now, what they realized was when they were examining my breast is that there was something which was still inside the breasts. And for me, I thought it was the scar tissue because I still had, you know, there was a scar and I had done the surgery 2 months prior to when I got in the program. So I was sent again to now start doing the test again, you know, the blood work, the ultrasound, MRIs, core biopsy, all this, which was costing quite a lot of money. So we did all that and it came back that the surgery I did before was not done properly. So I had to again go under the knife. Because I don't have big breasts, so I was told I might need, yes, there is an option of still doing a lumpectomy, you know, for them to remove just the lumps and surrounding tissues. But the problem would be that my breasts would really be disfigured since they had already removed a chunk of it. But I had that option to do another lumpectomy, then do radiotherapy, then be on hormonal therapy, the medication for 5 years, or do a mastectomy, which is now the removal of the whole breast, and then be on the hormonal therapy, the That was the medicine for 5 years. I opted for the surgery, the mastectomy, because it was the cheapest alternative, which was taking the shortest amount of time. And also because, you know, with the lumpectomy, what I learned was they might do it. You know, there might be a need for me to redo it again if they don't get everything out. So I just thought I didn't want to do that. And once you do the lumpectomy, it means you need to do radiotherapy, which is 30 sessions of them. A session can cost, you know, depending on where you're doing it, it can cost between, I think at the moment is 4,000 and 15,000 per session. You need 30 sessions. It also has, you know, effects on your body. So I was also looking at that. I knew radiotherapy is also tough on the body. 30 sessions are not few. And you need to do, I think, 5 a week, you know, Monday through Friday for how many weeks? 6 weeks, isn't it? Yeah, 6 by 5, yeah, 30. So now, first of all, because I was not very blessed when it comes to breasts, you know, having big breasts, I used to wear those push-up bras. Push-up bra in my tops and dresses had this cleavage. You know, that was my style. Having had the mastectomy, no, before agreeing to have a mastectomy, I didn't think about it. I didn't think about my physique or how I would look. I was really more concentrated, you know, more... I was really looking at the duration of the treatment and the amount of money I will need to sort it out. So for me, I just wanted to finish this treatment, go back to life. I wanted to go back to school. So I had not really thought about it. I was literally given these options of the surgeries and, you know, my treatment options on a Monday. And on the same Monday, I made the decision and booked for the mastectomy the same week on Friday. So I didn't really think about it. And right now, looking back, I feel like I knew if I thought about it longer, I wouldn't do it. So I just went ahead, made the decision. I managed to get in the welfare program of Aga Khan, because now with the Beyond Zero, they couldn't pay anything for me since I wasn't doing radiotherapy. But thankfully, the surgeon I met at Aga Khan, he, you know, sent me to now the welfare office and they waived some amount of the surgery. It was, I think the surgery back then was something like $500,000. And I paid a fraction of it. The rest, you know, the hospital waived. So I managed to do the surgery the same week. And when the results came out, I was cancer-free. The only challenge I had was now this hand, which had started swelling, and I needed to now start doing physiotherapy.
I hope you're enjoying this episode, and I'm so glad that you're part of this family. We're taking a small ad break, but we'll be right back. And now, back to the episode.
But it had still not hit me. I was still on autopilot the whole time. I'm telling you, it hit me, I think, sometime in 2017. Now, when I was trying one of the dresses which had a cleavage on. So I put it on. I'm telling you, I can remember this day as if it was yesterday. You know, I was putting on this dress. We were with my sister. And that is when I realized I cannot wear such dresses anymore, because I remember just telling my sister, you know, I really cannot, I can't wear this kind of clothes anymore. And I just kept quiet I was shocked for a while. And that is when now it dawned on me what had actually happened. That is when I started processing that I actually had a breast cancer diagnosis. This was at least a year later. And let me tell you, it took me down. I had such bad depression. I was in a dark place for quite a long time. I wasn't working. I was home most of the time. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was barely eating. You know, I was really isolating. I didn't have a social life at all, and even I wasn't relating with my family that much. At that time, I was living with my mom and sister and my niece, so I was really in this cloud of, oh my God, what just happened, you know? And I remember at some point really wishing that I would not have done the surgery. There is one call I remember receiving, and this is why I even stopped picking calls at that time. So I received a call from one lady from high school. So I received a call and she told me that she had about the diagnosis. By then, mind you, this time, during this period, I didn't want people to know. So there were really limited people who knew. Even the Harambe, you know, the fundraiser which was done. Now, taking you back before the surgery, the fundraiser which was done behind my back. I didn't know they were doing it. My family wanted us to do a fundraiser because we could not afford, you know, the treatments and the checkups. But I had told them not to. You know, I had told them I'll find a solution. That's why I was looking for this program, since I didn't want people to know. But I'm glad they did, because it really helped. So anyway, so this lady calls me and tells me that, you know, she had, and then she asked me about, you know, how it was. I told her about the mastectomy I did. And then I remember her just exclaiming and asking me, what? Why did you remove your breast? Why did you have your breast removed? Wow, you know, you could have done a surgery and reconstruction immediately. And, you know, like, that is the angle she was going with. So after the call, I was so devastated, because first of all, I didn't even know there was, you know, breast. At that time, I don't know if the option was there in Kenya. And even if it was, I could not afford it, you know, doing a reconstruction at the same time. And you see, it was done. So I couldn't do anything about it. So I would get such comments and they would just take me down even more. I would feel worse than before. So I got into, like, I did get into a lot of depression. And then I started through my, you know, family, and, you know, I was advised to just try therapy. So I started doing now therapy. That is when I started learning now more about my mental health. And of course, with therapy, you know, there's somewhere I think I was reading, or I had somebody saying, with therapy, it gets worse before it gets better. Because you're now, you know, going back to your childhood, yes, and the wounds, and you're, you know, addressing things you didn't even know you had a problem with. So it did get worse before it started getting better. So I think from 2017, around that time, I got a job with a non-profit organization. So I started working and I was still doing therapy. And it would get, you know, sometimes I would feel okay, sometimes not. So by around end of 2018, everything looked okay on the outside. You know, people also, there was a lot of pressure, you know, from people's expectations that, you know, I'm already cancer-free, I should already, you know, move on. And it was hard even talking about how I was really feeling with, you know, the people around me, because, you know, see, I need to move on already. And I had a good job, life looked really good. So there was a lot of pressure in terms of me moving on. And I also had the same pressure towards myself, because I was feeling like, you know, I've already done the hardest bit, why can't I already move on? So there was that. But thankfully, I was doing therapy. Then it got worse, I think, in 2018. I was having relationship. During all this period, I was dating. I was still dating even before I got the diagnosis. The same person I started dating when I was in high school. Now, this was 2018, so we were having also challenges. And I would even say, like, after the surgery, that we related differently in a more in-depth way, as opposed to really the whole diagnosis breaking the relationship. Of course, there are challenges there because, you see, again, I was feeling different. My self-image had already distorted. I didn't like who I was. My self-esteem had gone down. Not because of him, but because of how I was feeling and and how my definition of beauty was really, was not how I was looking. So there was that. And with the diagnosis, and this is not just the first one, but, throughout to date, I would say one of the challenges which also comes with this with the cancer diagnosis is also be the elephant in the room, whereby as much as there are treatment options out here, there's also this conversation or this topic which normally people don't talk about, but them about, mortality. Because the cancer really can go sideways, or the outcome is not always what we hope for. So that can mess a relationship up because you don't know. There's so many uncertainties. You also become I kid you not, I am here to meet one person who has been diagnosed with cancer and their personality has not changed. I'm yet to meet one person because it just changes your mindset, your perception in life. And sometimes, for the better, sometimes not so much. But you start looking at life differently. You start looking at, you start having discussions about death, a taboo topic. We don't normally like talking about this. But you see, this is part of life, whether you're ill or not. So those are some of the challenges which can affect a relationship. And this is also a challenge which we experience, or I experienced, because I felt like, as I said before, it was hard for me to talk about what I was actually feeling with the people around me, because there's that mentality of you've already finished treatment, you need to move on. But for me, I felt like I'm stuck and I didn't even know how to move on, because you can't even go back. Life becomes different. You can't even go back to how life was. It changes your life completely, this diagnosis.
Catch more African stories in the next episode of Legally Clueless.
What a wonderful story. There's so many things I connected with, and I want to share the top three. The first is the grace with which our parents restarted. They go through earth-shattering things, and there is a calmness through which they stride onto the next kids in tow. And when Mwende was talking about her father dying, after her mom basically losing her business because she had to be a caretaker to her dad, and then this fire that takes up everything, and before the fire, the funeral where the bishops or other pastors and this one uncle who completely take everything away. And there is a grace not only in how Mwende is telling the story, but like how her mom just picks up and keeps moving. And I don't know if I'm the only one. I watched my mom do this after she divorced my dad. Three kids, paying our school fees, trying to figure out where we're going to live, providing. And there's a grace with which my mom did that. And I'm just like, I don't have kids. And I wonder if I move. that, Grace. I don't know. I mean, there's an element of when you have kids, or even like alone, you just have to survive, right? But there's a grace many of our parents had when moving from a crisis into survival mode that I think is out of this world. I don't know if you've experienced that as well. The second thing is, my mom battled breast cancer for a decade, or just a little over a decade, on and off. And when Wendy was talking about lymphoma and her hand swelling up, I was just like, oh my God, I'd forgotten all of those days. I spent a lot of my later teen years into my early 20s helping my mom. Obviously, it was not just me. The entire family rallied around her. But I do remember, you know, every evening having to massage my mom's hand when it would swell up. And she also had the sleeve, so that compression sleeve, I think is what it's called. But I also remember my mom had these special bras. I've not thought about them until I listened to the story, right? I don't know what they're called, but because of the surgery and the treatment my mom went through, one of her breasts was not the same shape as the other, the breast that had the lump and the breast cancer, right? And so due to this, there's a special bra where you'd slip in like a breast mold, like a silicone breast mold into a special bra. And so you could wear whatever it is you want to wear that perhaps you prefer it looking like you have two same sized breasts. Maybe because it's not cleavage, but however you want the outfit to sit. And yeah, I just remember my mom had that. I wonder where they are, you know? And the third thing I thought about is one that I want to really hear from you on. Things you experience that make you confront your own mortality and the thoughts of your own death. And the effect those things have on your intimate relationships, right? So I think for me, it's definitely in seeing death so closely, the death of my mom, when I actively started processing that grief and confronting my own mortality and my own death, it definitely has an impact on intimate relationships for me. You know, top of mind, the first thing that I thought about is just, is this an authentic life? Like, did I choose to be in this relationship to fill a void for safety? If I knew my death was in a week or the next day, would I still choose to be in this relationship? Whew! Yeah. And if you have experienced something that has made you confront your own mortality, how did that affect your relationships, your intimate relationship? I would love to hear from you, honestly. It just popped up to me while listening to Monda's story. So If you have a story on that, please fill out our storyteller form. It's linked in the show notes. Also in the show notes is a resource on how you can do your own self-breast exam at home, as well as details on my own personal doctor, Dr. Sally, who's been on the podcast before. She does all my clinical breast exams. And so in case you want to see a doctor, I would definitely say, if you're in Nairobi, she's the person to see. This was part one of Wendy's story. Part two is out next week, and here's what you can expect.
I did that till around 2022, where I could no longer afford my treatment, and there was also a lot of medical negligence, so I felt mentally fatigued. So I just stopped and I continued hiking. And you know, I actually didn't even tell my family I had stopped treatment. It was so expensive. I'm telling you, it was so expensive. We could not afford it anymore. So I just decided, you know, I'll continue hiking and ticking off the items on my list. Yeah, I was told I had 1 year to live in 2019. But now in 2021, you see, I've already been told that I don't have any cancer which is present in my body.
That's it for this episode of Legally Clueless. You can share this podcast with your friends. You can keep it for yourself. I'm not judging. Just make sure you're here next week for the next episode.